Our next case, 2018-1331, in the matter of KM. For the appellant, Mr. Avery.
Thank you, Chief Justice. Excuse me, may it please the court. I'm Darren Avery on behalf of Mother Appellant. The issue here, the sole issue, is whether the time requirement in Revised Code 2151-35B1 requires the juvenile court to dismiss a case if it has not held the dispositional hearing by 90 days after the date of the filing of the complaint. To start this issue, or begin looking at this issue, I think it's important to recognize the principle of Linger v. Weiss. That is, excuse me, juvenile courts are a creation of statute, so the statute controls. The statute, the plain language of the statute is a juvenile court can continue a dispositional hearing, first, for a time not to exceed the time allowed by that division. Second, that time is not to be more than 90 days after the date of the filing of the complaint. And finally, if it doesn't do it by then, the court shall dismiss on the motion of any party or the guardian ad litem or even the court's own motion.
Can the 90 days be waived?
I don't believe it can. Specifically because of the mention of the guardian ad litem and the emphasis in Revised Code 2151 on the interests of the child. If it's waived, well, first off, who could waive it? Can the parent waive it? It seems contradictory to say, hey, this parent is of questionable, exercising a questionable diligence in caring for his kids. Can he waive this thing that is a benefit or a right of the child? And I would argue it's a right of the child, specifically, one, because of the limbo for the kid during the proceedings, one. Two, because the time limits of a temporary custody order in 353G, the one-year time limit, doesn't start to run until a 353 order is issued, and that happens after disposition. So in the meantime, in that 90 days or however long it takes, there is no time limit running apart from that 90 days. So I would say no. Because the plain language of the statute is unambiguous, there's quite a bit of case law saying no need to interpret. The court's duty is to follow that statute. Of course, as I mentioned in the brief, or developed in the brief, Farrar from Farrar dealt with shall as it pertains to time limits for performing official duties. Made a rule about that being directory rather than mandatory. Unless the object is discernible. Now, it relied on some foreign cases, and those different rationale come to this basically the same outcome. One of them had to do with, well, you look to whether it has to do with protection of private rights. The other two deal with legislative intent. One specifically deals with, well, discerning legislative intent through determining whether the statute gives a remedy or provides a remedy or leaves that open. And the other one is kind of a totality of the legislation type thing.
Are you talking about the Davis case?
I'm talking about Farrar. And
okay, about the Davis case?
Davis flat out said the rule is, it is, again, directory unless the language limits the power of the officer. And the language here says the officer of the court shall dismiss on the motion of any party if the hearing is held inside that time limit. And in fact, the Fifth District in 2001 said, yes, that language is there. They applied Davis to this very scenario and said.
Well, didn't the Davis was dealing with the section that required a 7-day for the dispositional hearing, correct?
That dealt with the 7-day time to issue a judgment after dispositional hearing is held.
Okay.
And that's in B3.
A judgment within 7 days of the dispositional, and they said that shall was directory and not mandatory.
Correct. That B3, that's in B3, and B3, sorry, 2151.35B3.
Right.
That contains no language limiting the power of the officer. The language about dismissal in B1 is a separate paragraph immediately after the 90-day time limit for holding the dispositional hearing.
Counsel, your friends on the other side say that Mother did not exhaust all of her remedies, that she should have filed an original action. How do you respond to that argument?
As I did in the brief, Your Honor, there's a statutory remedy, and the case law says there's no room for an extraordinary writ where that remedy exists. And it's right, I mean, it's literally the sentence after the time limit. It says, shall dismiss if the court, if it's not done in that time on the motion of any party. In other words, she's a party, she's Mother, she filed the, she did it orally in this case, and they raised that issue, I believe the trial court said, or the appellate court, one of the others said, didn't raise that in writing 7 days before, according to Juvenile Rule 22. Well, to that, I would go back to Linger, which says the rules can't expand or contract the jurisdiction of a juvenile court. The statute trumps the rules, in other words. And in fact, Juvenile Rule, I believe 44, explicitly says that. So, okay, if the jurisdiction of the court is limited, it doesn't matter whether it's raised orally or in writing. Juvenile Rule 22 can.
I assume you would add to that response that not only does it give a timeline, but it also says if that timeline isn't met, that it shall be dismissed without prejudice.
Correct, yeah. And in fact, that I would say that second shall, that shall dismiss is not, doesn't technically fall under the Davis rule. It's not a shall do this thing inside of time. It's shall dismiss if this condition is not met.
Okay. Counselor, so when it says the dispositional hearing shall not be held more than 90 days after the date on which the complaint was filed, what does held mean? Does that mean it has to start or it has to finish? I'm not sure it matters in this case, but I'm curious about that.
I would say that's an open question. There is a case out there, an appellate case I don't recall, and I didn't include it in the brief that says, I believe, commenced. However, the language in B3 says after it's completed, yeah, they have 7 days. I would say held, it seems to me held means completed, but I don't have authority for that, and it's tough to find. Okay, if there are no further questions at the moment, there's this language, Mother moved for dismissal. I believe the other explanation about waiver was Mom didn't comply with the investigation of the Children's Services Department, and there's no authority that says she has to comply with any investigation or anything like that. And there is no exception delineated or any exceptions enumerated in that statute.
So non-compliance can just be held against her, and there's a presumption then, what, if they don't have the evidence to bring to the hearing that has to be all tied up in 90 days, what do you do about that?
That's their problem. They're the complainant.
No, actually, it's your client's problem.
Well, they're the complainant. I mean, they have to acquire evidence. It's not my...
Right, and they can't inquire evidence because the parent is non-cooperative, so...
Well, prior to an adjudication and an order, PSO, she has no duty to cooperate with them. They could seek evidence through discovery early on, but there's nothing like that in here. I mean,
I'm presuming that if your client does not want to see the outcome with regard to children or any client, any parent, that they don't cooperate at first, which is sometimes very typical given the scenario of what happens in juvenile court under these circumstances. But then, for some reason, maybe the attorney is able to convince his client or her client to be cooperative, and that doesn't happen till, the 80th day or whatever, however long it takes. Maybe the parent needs to become sober. Maybe a lot of things need to happen. So the parent then decides that they do have good things to say to the investigator, but that's all cut off now.
Well, as soon as the complaint is filed, there are adversaries, and the parent can say good things to the court at the hearing, at the adjudication. So I don't see the need or the duty to communicate those things to the adversary, which is, in this case, is the agency, but it could be any other party, any other person, rather.
Okay, all right.
I would like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Counsel?
Chief Justice, Justices, good morning. I'm Edith Gilland for the Appalachian Richland County Children's Services. It is true that juvenile courts are unique animals, and as such, they
also,
are.
Can you pull the microphone closer and speak into it?
I'm sorry. It is true, Your Honors, that juvenile courts are unique animals, and as such, they are given wide latitude in the decisions and the handlings of their cases when it regards the children. I think in looking at this question about whether the shall is considered mandatory or directory, I think we have to start by looking at the beginning of 2151 in point 01, where it clearly says that these sections shall be liberally interpreted and construed to affect the following purposes, and that is to provide for the care and protection of children. In this particular case, 215135B and the 90-day time limit, we have to take a look at this as the difference between the black and white letter of the law and the practical outcome. I have not heard from appellant what the harm was to the client in the failure to conduct or to complete this hearing within the 90 days. Further, that appellant sat on the right to file a timely motion to dismiss. At the time they became aware that the hearing had been set outside the 90-day time limit.
But doesn't the statute put the obligation on not just the appellant, but on the judge to dismiss?
It does allow that the judge can do that on its own accord. Again, as a practical matter, Your Honor, I think we would all agree that we would like to be able to practice in courts without crowded dockets, but the reality of the situation is sometimes that's not possible. And in this case, when the appellant sat on their right and didn't file a motion, at which time it could have been brought to the attention of the court and given them time potentially to correct the scheduling, that wasn't done. And in fact, a written motion was never filed in this case to dismiss.
But again, is that incumbent upon the appellant?
I think it is, Your Honor. I think because if the appellant wants to assert the rights, if this court were to allow the appellant to sit on those rights.
But there's nothing in the statute that requires the appellant to let the court know the time is nearing.
I think the appellant has an obligation to file a motion to dismiss if they're aware ahead of time that the hearing has been set outside the time limit. That doesn't restrict the court's ability to dismiss on its own motion.
Wouldn't the appellant have to wait till the 91st day to file a motion?
No, I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Why not?
I mean,
there's no harm till that 90th day is passed, right?
Well, I don't believe there's harm even when the 91st day passes. I think if we allow the appellant to sit on their rights and not assert them timely, it sends a bad message. And I think then we're going to be overwhelmed with cases where you sit on your rights before you assert them and then claim foul as part of an appeal when the case doesn't go your way.
But isn't the statute designed to protect the child so the child doesn't get left in the system?
Absolutely. I absolutely
agree. And so the legislature, I mean, we didn't write this.
Right.
They wrote 90 days. Maybe it's 100 days. I don't know.
Right.
But the point is they're trying to protect the child with the 90-day limit.
Exactly right, Your Honor, and that's why I believe
And so shouldn't
that.
We enforce it then?
That's why I believe you should determine that, as you did, this court did in In re Davis for B3 in 215135B3, that it's directory. I believe this court should also interpret this section as directory as well, because not doing so absolutely is a detriment to the child, because requiring dismissal is going to do away immediately with potential pretrial or ex parte orders having been put in place to
Counsel,
protect those
it can
children.
Be immediately refiled, can it not?
That is correct.
Okay, this is without prejudice.
That is
and
correct.
Your opposing counsel mentioned that this is an adversarial proceeding. As soon as a complaint is brought against the family or the mother, father, whatever. So you're saying when the court sets the hearing, and everybody gets notice, and the parent realizes that the date set is beyond the 90 days that is referred to in the statute, it's their obligation in an adversarial setting to say, wait a second, you're outside of the time limit that the statute provides, even though if you are outside of it, the case gets dismissed, the adversarial proceedings go away, and I'm in a better position in relationship to my child.
I believe if their argument is that to consider it mandatory and to do away with their obligation to bring it to the court's attention and file a motion, I don't know how that helps his the appellant's client. Because if failure to assert your right, then only is going to delay the case for his client as well.
And it's going to what? I'm sorry?
It will delay the case for the client as well when, as Your Honor said, it can be immediately refiled. As a child welfare agency, of course, this is governmental intrusion into the privacy of families. However, in this case, to make the determination as to mandatory as opposed to directory, the argument here is being made that it's fatal to the court's jurisdiction beyond the 90th day. I would disagree with that. It doesn't follow logically for this court to say that it is directory for the language in B3, the 7 days to issue the ruling after the disposition.
Well, maybe I could see the parent holding their breath that this case is going to be dismissed. It's going to take maybe some time to refile it. In the meantime, yes, my child is probably in foster care or in kinship care, et cetera. But this additional time is going, and I'm on the road to sobriety or I'm on the road to whatever, and this is going to give me more time to make a better case. I mean, I can see some sort of strategy that might be in place here. That it would be against the interest of the parent to be, you know, sound the alarm that the court, overstepped the 90 days.
Yes, but if indeed the parent would want more time to make progress, then why would the 90 days be detrimental to that family?
Well, it may or may not be, but the right doesn't arise until the 90th day comes, or at least the invocation of the statute doesn't arise until after
the
90 days. So for whatever reasons, strategic or not, how do we reconcile a statute that says this has to be done within 90 days or it shall be dismissed without prejudice?
I believe the answer to that, Your Honor, is that the determination turns on the issue of whether or not it's fatal to the court's jurisdiction. So my response to you would be that once a complaint is filed and service is protected, the jurisdiction of the juvenile court attaches at that point. Okay. The due process rights of the families involved are protected all along the process by proper notice, by the recitation of their rights for Rule 29, their right to court-appointed counsel, their right to full hearing. And once you get to the adjudicatory stage and the court has issued an adjudication, then the focus at that point turns solely to what's in the best interest of the child and not what is in the best interest of the parents. And that is why I believe that the 90-day time limit is directory, as in the best interest of the child.
But wouldn't the refiling of the complaint do all the same thing?
It would, but it would put the child at risk, Your Honor. It would further delay because you're starting all over. You're doing away with pretrial orders that may have put the children in a custodial situation for their protection. You would be regarding service. It would further delay the case well beyond what the original delay complained of may have resulted in.
But if it's directory, is it 100 days? Is it 200 days? When does it, who protects, make sure that the system is watching that child and that child's interest as soon as possible?
Well, I think that's up to the trial court and it's up to the child welfare agency, and that's why we do pretrial orders and we make sure that the child is being protected until the case.
Don't they know the calendar? The court is setting the date along with the advocate, which is the child services agency. They know when the 90-day, I mean, like any case where there's deadlines, you better have a big red mark on the outside of your file to tell you the drop-dead date. So when the court sets it, it's easily brought to the court's attention that it's outside of the 90 days and you need to speed it up.
Right, and I would agree. I think the reality of that situation, Your Honor, is that the courts are just frankly overwhelmed with these cases, and especially so in recent years because of how
that.
The opioid crisis has affected the children and families that we deal with specifically.
Well, and I get all of that, and all of the things you assert make perfect sense. But the legislature also knew how to say, unless good cause is shown, this should happen within 90 days. And it didn't do that either.
It did not, but it also doesn't specifically say it's fatal to the court's jurisdiction.
Well, true. And so saying, but does it matter whether we say it's void, as in lack of jurisdiction, or it's voidable, as in the court has jurisdiction, however, the court operated outside of the statute?
I think there's always a situation wherein the time frame as it passes the 90 days becomes unreasonable, of course. I think that we have to trust that the trial court would exercise its appropriate discretion in that issue. Certainly, if it's a docket issue and the case is set, as in this case was, I believe, less than 20 days past the 90-day time limit, I certainly think that you could say that's reasonable given the circumstances and given the scheduling difficulties that courts must deal with. And at some point, yes, I would agree with you that maybe the time delay becomes unreasonable.
So you're saying that a reviewing court could declare that, yes, the court proceeded in violation of the statute, not necessarily without jurisdiction, but in violation of the statute, but such a violation was harmless?
Yes, absolutely, Your Honor. That's what I would assert in that case, because if it's not fatal to jurisdiction, then there would be a determination of reasonableness.
Counsel, if we would side here with the appellant, what does that require we do with Davis?
I think that's in conflict with this court's prior decision in Davis, because the rule—
I understand that. What do we do with Davis?
Well, I think if you side for appellant in this matter, I think that would overturn Davis, Your Honor, because the ruling that the determination you made as discretionary or directory in Davis affects a time that comes after the 90 days.
What's your experience on the hearing of these cases? In other words, the failure to meet the 90-day deadline, is that more often that way or less often, especially given the circumstances and the fact that the overwhelming of the juvenile systems these days?
Yes, in my experience, Your Honor, I believe that this, my court specifically, makes every effort to meet these deadlines. I think that many times it's just not possible because of the schedule of the attorneys involved and the docket of the court. But I do think they make a professional and good faith effort to do so. But I would say it's probably more often than not.
Is it, in your opinion, would ease things up if the legislature would expand the time from 90 days to maybe, I don't know, 120, 180?
I think it would be helpful maybe not to put a time certain on it, but to say that there needs to be, it's directory, and there needs to be some test of reasonableness for the reason for the delay. And if that, the reason for the delay.
So keep it 90, but then put in a safety hatch.
Yes. And that the reason for the delay should be well documented by the court on the record during the case as to why the delay had to occur.
Counsel.
Yes.
On the statute, I hear your argument about jurisdiction, but if the legislature didn't care about the jurisdiction, it could have ended the statute with the words dismiss the complaint.
I agree. But
instead, it added without prejudice. So isn't that its statement that this is jurisdictional?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because I had that very thought in my reading of that. To me, if they meant it to be fatal to jurisdiction, they would have said, shall dismiss, full stop. They didn't do that. But what they did say is, to me, that could be read as a direction to the court that if you decide on your own motion or upon the motion of any party to execute a dismissal, it must be without prejudice, that you cannot dismiss it
right, with
prejudice. And I think that's a fair alternate reading of that section. I think if it was meant to be fatal to jurisdiction, they would have said, you shall dismiss it, full stop.
But if they did that, then they would not be telling the court or the trial court that it can be refiled. So by saying without prejudice, they're saying you lose the case is out of jurisdiction, but you can refile.
Right.
And that to protect the child, too.
I think that the legislature may have intended it to be that way, but in reality and practice, I don't think that's the result that would happen from it.
Counsel, couldn't trial courts just have the parties exercise a written waiver?
Yes. Yes, they could, and I believe our court has started doing that pending this case.
Okay.
And I think that would be cleaner.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
All right.
I see I'm out of time, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
Counsel?
Thank you, Chief Justice. I want to start with the what do you do with Davis question. It seems reasonable to think Farrar and Davis are wrong in light of the case law about the plain language and particularly the meaning of shall. And Dorian says something about shall be construed as mandatory unless the language clearly demonstrates otherwise, I think is the language of Dorian. However, Davis specifically says it's directory unless there's language limiting the power of the officer, and that language is present in B1, it's not present in B3. That is how you make the distinction, and it's not necessary to do anything with Davis if you rule for appellant. You can compare the language of the statute prior to 1979. Linger itself dealt with that, Linger v. Weiss, and it said, look, the statutes trump the rules, even though Juvenile Rule 34 at the time said 90 days is the time limit. It doesn't matter because 2151.23 says the juvenile court has jurisdiction of a child alleged to be abused, neglected, or dependent. And then the legislature amended 2151.
Counsel, let me ask, I asked your friend on the other side the same question. Rather than watering down the word shall and interpreting it as directory or mandatory, wouldn't it be just better just to enforce the statute? And if your client anticipated some type of prejudice by going forward within that, you could sign a written waiver?
Yes.
That would remedy this entire situation.
Right, and I would argue that Farrar should have watered down maybe vacant instead of shall, and we wouldn't have this problem. And, you know, you can obviously re-examine that if you like. As far as more often than not going over time and practical experience, it's not my practical experience, no. They do ask for waivers if they think it's going to, but practically speaking, they're not going over time. In my experience, it's not in the record. But obviously, we have another one that happened within a couple of months, and that's the next case. These, I think, were both exceptional. As far as adding a reasonableness clause or adding any kind of reasonableness case law, all that's going to do is add delay litigating what's reasonable. Why is it reasonable? Why not? Other things, party can only assert a right once it actually accrues. I think that's solid in case law. So, yes, she had to wait until day 91. As far as did she have a duty to raise the issue once the hearing was scheduled prior to day 90, I don't see any case law or any authority saying she had that duty. In the criminal context, the speedy trial context, definitely not. There are cases saying, look, the attorney was at the hearing or it was continued, and he was simply silent, and that doesn't mean he can't waive or can't raise the speedy trial issue later. And related, mom didn't really sit on this too long. It was only 16 days after day 90. She did raise it in the trial court. She didn't wait till appeal. As far as showing harm, the statute doesn't say she has to show harm. And back to the language, yeah. Had the General Assembly wanted to make it a non-jurisdictional mandate or a directory mandate, they could have included language as in 414A2, which says concerning a permanent custody, there's a timeline for permanent custody hearing, and it says specifically, you know, failure to follow this timeline doesn't provide any basis for attacking the jurisdiction of the court. So they know how to write that as well. And similar, well, B3 doesn't include any dismissal language, so they know how to just stop at shall not hold it after 90 days. Instead, they added the paragraph that says shall dismiss if they don't. You're correct, parties can refile, and that's what happened in the Howard v. Catholic Social Services case. It's a series of cases. There are many refilings in that case, so it's practically workable. As far as why, what other protection? Well, 2151 doesn't simply contemplate the interests of the children. It contemplates the protection of everybody's rights. It says so in 2151.01. Ensuring the protection of the rights of all interested parties, I believe, is a language. Obviously, parents are parties, and they have an interest. And as I argued already, I think the children have an interest in having limbo ended and in having that clock start on temporary custody orders as soon as possible. If there are no further questions, I would ask that you reverse and instruct the lower court to dismiss the case. Thank you.
Thank you.